Hi, and welcome to QS Cast. I'm your host, Doug Lynn, and I'm joined today by Chaz Volpe.
Hello.
As well as Kelly Reed.
Hi there.
We are going to talk about our first impressions of the full Battle for Zendikar spoiler. So you're going to get discussions about single cards today, about older cards today, and you're also going to get some top-level views about how this format is going to shape up. So we have a lot to talk about today. One of the things I hit in my Insider article was that there are still going to be many archetypes that are still alive, and there are some, frankly, pretty weird things that we get to play with that are new, but there are still going to be interesting things that we were able to do before. One of the big strategies coming out is Ramp, and Ramp is interesting because it fits into the existing red-green devotion sort of shell where the top end was Dragonlord Atarka. And first, I want to throw it to you, Chaz, because you were telling us a little bit about testing with Oblivion Sower and some of the new Eldrazi, and maybe you could tell us more about that and how it shapes Atarka Red and the Red-Green Devotion lists.
Okay, so I fired up, I've just started piecing together a couple lists, revising them yesterday, basically all day. So Sunday, we're recording today. Now, again, let me preface this. I'm not a professional player, so this is just a full day of just playing on Cockatrice and just grinding some games against other, I guess at this point, rogue decks or some decks from insider articles on various sites or, you know, from other podcasts like Top Level Podcasts. I did see that this Landfall deck that I'll be talking about a little bit. So I wrote an article this week or the past week on the 18th about, you know, some initial questions about what we were talking about going into Battle for Zendikar, traditional Ramp, See the Unwritten, where Standard might be. And just from initial testing, so we've talked about a couple cards. Oblivion Sower is definitely strong. Rattleclaw Mystic is definitely in the mix. And Ramp just seems really good in the sense that traditional Ramp, getting to like that 10 mana top end of Ulamog is very real. I mean, it's really not that hard off the back of an Oblivion Sower without even factoring in Crumple to Dust. I know we talked about that interaction last cast, but it's just very strong. And swinging that kind of those lands in your favor, coming in untapped, and then having basically enough to cast Ulamog a turn after the Sower, or a couple turns later, is just insane. So I have a couple notes here. The Landfall deck from that episode is very real. Do not be fooled. It looks like a failed Battle for Zendikar draft deck with McKindy, Slide Runner, Snapping Gnarled. But I played the deck a couple times over the course of the day and got destroyed playing the Ramp deck. And so that's where little like penny stock cards that we mentioned, like Radiant Flames was a really good performer, just because the mana bases of these deck lists is so fluid that you can make a two color deck and have four colors in the deck, you know, no problem. So I'm really liking Radiant Flames so far. Oblivion Sower, again, like I mentioned, From Beyond was a really good player in that deck. So, again, I'm just testing out a couple of things. Another card that was kind of surprising was Conduit of Ruin at that sixth slot. So I don't know how that slot is going to play out. So maybe you might want to play Sower and Conduit in tandem, because both are obviously very good. You want both, but it's just kind of like a numbers game at this point, which one you will want more of. So those are just some like initial reactions. Atarka Red is very scary too. That deck can kill you very fast.
I'm glad that you brought up Radiant Flame. It's a card that Brian DeMars had highlighted in his article today. He had said about it, we have lost our sweepers like Drown in Sorrow and Anger of the Gods, and he said, this is a completely modular spell. And he reminded the readers of Firespout, and he said, look, Firespout was a dominant card when it was printed, This gives you even more control, and if you're playing three colors, you can do one of those cute things where you wipe out their entire board and you keep everything on your side. If I'm playing allies, I'm going to be thinking of really long and hard about how you beat Radiant Flames on three, sweeping away your first three turns worth of work. And right now, Radiant Flames is a very inexpensive pickup, so that's one of the ones I'm going to highlight as a pretty good undervalued card.
Yeah, I mean, this is not one of those cards that's going to be like $8 to $10. The card I can mostly draw a parallel to in terms of like a price trajectory for Radiant Flames is like Exquisite Firecraft. So this is like the card that's going to be under a dollar. You could probably trade, you know, maybe under a dollar for at your pre-release, pick up a good couple sets of them. And these are the small gainers that go from the $1 to like $4, and you can start buy-listing them for $3 or something like that. So it's just like a very small victory. And yeah, it's just a very good and much-needed card for the upcoming metagame, because with this Landfall deck and Atarka Red and stuff like that, it's going to be well-needed.
Kelly, you had written recently about great foil common and uncommon pickups, and I like to mention these because there can be a lot of money to be made picking up the Treasure Cruises the first week and then seeing them jump up to $20, for example. You had listed over a dozen. Could you give me three or four of your favorite cards that you would say to target as one of these cheap kind of penny stock cards?
Absolutely. I'm going to set aside pet cards like Dispel, which I want to pick up for mostly the art. I'm going to pull the article up right now, and asking me to pick my favorite three is tough. The reason I put 17 of them on my list is because I like to buy baskets, not individuals. I love all of the tribal colorless creatures. So that's Ruination Guide, the 3/2 blue Devoid for 3 mana with Ingest, and he pumps the power of all your other colorless creatures.
I think you made a very good point that that's a card that pumps Thopters, it pumps Eldrazi Spawn, it even works well for the Ingester decks.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really important card, and it's aggressively costed, it's a Devoid enabler, and we're really starting to see that there are a lot of reasons why an Ingest enabler. We are starting to see a number of reasons that Ingest creatures are going to matter, and he is big enough that he's probably going to trade with something relevant, or he's going to connect for some damage. Is it uncommon? So there aren't going to be as many foils as it might first appear. I think the foils of the Devoid cards are going to look absolutely amazing because they are full art, even though they're also texted, and they've got that weird pattern on the top. Also, this guy is blue, and so he benefits from playing islands. And I guess a corollary to that are the two one-drop Devoid Ingesters, which are Salvage Drone, the 1-mana 1/1 in Devoid blue. He has Ingest, and when he dies, you can choose to loot. The other one is Sludge Crawler, 1/1 black Devoid Ingest. You can +1/+1 him for 2 mana. So I don't know if you need all of them to make some sort of linear blue-black colored Devoid deck, but the fact is that you can all these colorless creatures just get so much better in the presence of Ghost Fireblade. And I'm sure I sound like a broken record between forums and insider articles and the podcast, but I'm just so into that card. I mean, I want to take it on a date and I want to marry it. It's just amazing. I mean, like, if you play with Bone Splitter during Mirrodin, you remember that 1 mana to drop, 1 mana to equip, +2/+0 could break a game wide open on turn 2, and this is even better. So all the guys that benefit from Ghost Fireblade, another one that I actually think is the best use case is the 05, Devoid Blue, and 1/2 drop. All your other colorless creatures get +0/+1. That thing is huge for its mana cost, and yeah, it doesn't have a power, but again, Ghost Fireblade makes him a 2/7 2-drop. Other cards that I think are important, Colostria Healer, which is the 1/2 Vampire Ally for black 1. He, or another ally enters the battlefield, you drain each opponent for a life. I think that's going to be a very important card. It's got a bunch of relevant tribal types, it's got cool art, and it's the kind of card that gets better in multiples. I can see it being used in some sort of stupid ally commander deck, but yeah, I don't know. A Blister Pod, man, another Devoid creature that I absolutely love. I think there's going to be an aggressive strategy built around these really dirt cheap colorless 1 and 2 drops. Blisterpod is the 1-1 for 1 green, Devoid. It does not have Ingest, so that kind of informs what strategy you're going to be going with here. But when it dies, you get a Scion. So he's an amazing, amazing target for Ghostfire Blade, because when you get a 3-3, and then when he dies, you get another 3-3. So I'm extremely excited for that one.
Another card I'd like to pick out as a foil pickup as an uncommon for people to scout for is Zulaport Cutthroat. It is the new Blood Artist. Blood Artist was a phenomenally fan-favorite card. I don't know that it is... It saw some play in Aristocrats. Zulaport Cutthroat, you know, they're kind of laying the idea there where you sacrifice Eldrazi Scions and you can life drain your opponent. But this is a very fun, casual card that people like. And I expect that this, much like Blood Artist, will command a premium. So these are ones you pull out of your bulk, and I definitely like the idea of picking up cheap foils of Zulaport Cutthroat.
Blood Artist is like a $2 uncommon at this point. So,
and that's not going to last long, because the Cutthroat's going to drop the price down, but yeah, definitely.
In the long run, though, you can probably get these dirt cheap and just sit on them for a while. There's actually a ton of these that I think are really important, like Herald of Kozilek, the 2-4 for 3 in Izzet colors, that lets you cheat a mana on your colorless spells, and then Ulamog's Nullifier, the Mystic Snake Eldrazi, Transgress the Mind. But I think my picks, Doug, you covered this in your article today on Insider. The spell lands, Blighted Fen and Blighted Woodland, specifically. I mean, Blighted Fen is a diabolic edict on a land. Blighted Woodland is an explosive vegetation built into a land. Blighted Woodland's like one of the best lands I've ever seen. It's so good.
It's two landfall triggers, which is a big thing, too. There are a lot of decks that will want to be getting a whole bunch of landfall triggers, and being able to trigger them at instant speed and get two is really good, too.
Yeah, it's crazy, and am I wrong to think that this is a $5 foil waiting to happen?
I think all the blue, black, and green blighted cards are going to be phenomenally good. It's sad that red and white didn't get enough, but you know,
what does
like
the blue
I said,
one
I've,
do?
I've played with a lot of Barbarian Ring in my day. The blue one draws you cards, which is amazing. You know, it's hard to find a deck that doesn't want to transform its late land drops into blue draw if they're playing islands. So I definitely like that card a lot. I like all those spell lands. I am really psyched for them. You had brought up Ulamog's Nullifier. Ulamog's Nullifier is a 2-3 flying flash devoid card that when it comes into play, you can put two cards from your opponent's exile zone into their graveyard to counter a spell. This reminds me of Mystic Snake, and Mystic Snake had basically the same ability, a few less hoops to jump through, but a little bit more mana intensive. And no flying, nothing fun like that. But it was a card that was very good in Standard at the time, and I see this being as good in Standard as Mystic Snake was, because there are all those one-drops ingesters. Another thing that a buddy of mine brought up was that Ulamog's Nullifier may be a modern playable card, and the reason why is that if you play cards like Relic of Progenitus or Ashiok in your main deck, then you're always going to, or even Path to Exile, then you're going to accumulate cards in the opponent's exile zone that you can use Ulamog's Nullifier to counter. And I just love the idea of hitting somebody with a Flash 2-3 flyer. I mean, I have played Restoration Angel just as a 3-4 Flash flyer as much as I can. And this was a card that made us look at Ashiok. Ashiok is rotating. It's currently between 5 and 650. I expect the price to drop down more. Ashiok is most certainly a modern playable card. Ashiok has the interesting ability that it really, really wrecks Grixis control. There's just about no way for them to get it off the board. So we like the card for that reason. I'm fascinated by the idea of playing a set of Ulamog's Nullifiers, maybe even in place of Cryptic Commands, or alongside them, and using them plus Ashiok plus, let's say, two Relic of Progenitus main deck, 2-4, and seeing where that gets you.
Yeah, I think Ashiok's a really interesting pick here, because he's one of the rare 3-drop planeswalkers in the game. The important part here is he comes down on 3, ticks up to 5 immediately, so he's pretty hard to kill at that point, and then immediately on curve, you have a guaranteed Ulamog's Nullifier that will counter the next spell.
And let me tell you some other things I like about Ulamog's Nullifier, specifically in the modern format. It cannot be dispelled, and it cannot be negated, owing to the fact that it is a creature. And being able to dodge those two things is really, really big. Dispel is everywhere. Dispel has ruined enough of my dreams. So I'm glad to see something that can worm its way past that stuff.
I got a question for you. Do you pre-order Ulamog's Nullifier at 15 cents? Because at that price point, you can get about 100 of them.
I don't think it ever gets cheaper than that.
Do you think it ever gets... But we're talking about buying 100 copies of an uncommon. You're not doing it so you can fill your bathtub with them. You're trying to get liquidity. Do you think it ever sees a buy price of... I think for it to be worth my time, I'd want a buy price of 75 cents.
And I would throw that to Chaz and get your opinion on that, Chaz, because we're talking about how widespread Battle for Zendikar is going to be opened, and it's really going to be pushing down the price on a lot of the rares, much less the uncommons are going to be near worthless.
I mean, it comes down to opportunity cost, obviously, like, and your time. I mean, do you really want to chance buying 100 Ulamog's Nullifier, and then I guess you can't even buy them back or buy list them back at 10 cents at that point because they're not rare. So I mean, I guess it's certainly a good uncommon, and I'm not faulting you for picking that uncommon because it's one of the better ones in the set. I'm just not super excited about buying 100 Ulamog's Nullifiers. I'm really not excited about buying any of the uncommons in the set because, I mean, there's been uncommons in the last few sets that are still kind of, like, hanging around. Like, we don't know where they're going to end up. I mean, Valorous Stance was one of those uncommons that was really worth buying at, like, the 20 cents if you were to be able to find them because it was one of those uncommons that increased in price. So, I don't know. I mean, the same could be said about Silumgar's Scorn, right? The double blue. I mean, I'd be much rather inclined to buy those than Ulamog's Nullifier if I was going to go back and look at uncommons as a source of like liquidity or just a buy list arbitrage out.
So here are the stats, by the way, on Cons of Tarkir. I pulled up the commons and uncommons that are worth more than a dime. So if you were buying in at this point, let's say you were buying any of these at 15 cents, Monastery Swift Spear, buy list for $1.80. That's anomalous. We can all recognize that. Hordling Outburst is 85 cents. Sandstep Citadel is 40 cents. Why is that? Well, it's an Abzan. Secret of the Way is a quarter. Mystic Monastery is a quarter. Stubborn Denial is 20 cents. Abzan Charms, 17. And then rounding out at Murderous Cut at 15 cents. So there are a few cards in there that you could have bought for 15 cents and held on to. And I bring this up because Cons was the most open set of its time in our estimation. And even with it being so widely open, there are still a few cards that you really, you want to be opening it up and you want to be finding a Swift Spear in your pack. So there are still some opportunities. I don't know. Swift Spear hit it out of the ballpark because it's played in Red Burn in every single format, and it's a natural card to go alongside an existing deck like Delver. Ulamog's Nullifier, I don't see the case there. I see, like, well, if Sandstep Citadel is only 40 cents, and that's the bedrock of the deck that plays Siege Rhino, then I have a hard time finding another card being more than that. But I also think that if you sunk $3 or $4 into buying several dozen of these, you probably wouldn't be sad even if they never hit.
So what if you, this is a good opportunity to talk about the difference between different types of traders. If you are running an online store and you want to have two dozen of playable uncommons in stock, and you're not buying sealed product, this might be one of those things where you just spend the money, because if you say, well, what would you set your buy list for Ulamog's Nullifier? I mean, I'd be glad to buy them at 15 cents if I ran a buy list, because you can probably out them at quarters all day long. And yeah, okay, 10 cents on your spread isn't nothing, but remember, as a store, you need to have the stock, period. You have to be able to say yes to the customer in front of you, whether that customer is in your store physically or on your online store or on your online marketplace or viewing your eBay account. You just need to have the stock. So I think there's a case for it, but I don't think it's the kind of play that a... average trader needs to bother with.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to look at it from that perspective. Like, yes, if I owned a store and I needed the stock, that's one thing. But I mean, I don't own a store, so you have to kind of look at all the different angles. Like, just coming from my angle, like, I don't own a storefront, I don't really need the stock, and just paying the $2 or whatever just to ship them out to a buy list almost, like, eradicates half the stock right there. I mean, if I'm making 10 cents on a card to a buy list, I mean, the shipping alone almost kills it. So, I don't know, maybe you can, maybe if you were to trade it in and get the 30% trade-in bonus for a store credit, then maybe, you know, that's something different. You're basically buying store credit at, like, a cheaper cost. So, you know, that's a decent play. And not to say that there couldn't be a uncommon in this set that's worth doing it. You know, another really good uncommon that, again, you guys were talking about uncommons, you know, Hedron Archive. That was pretty good, even in testing. I mean, that's something that a ramp-style deck is going to be wanting to pack four of. It's a good EDH. I don't know really too much about EDH. I'm not really an EDH aficionado, but I'm assuming it's one of those cards in EDH that'll be serviceable down the line. So I would be fine with buying Hedron Archives at like 15 cents. So again, I'm not saying that there's not the opportunity, but you know, you just have to weigh the cost of buying like 100 of these. So I don't know.
Well, we can circle back to an earlier show where we talked about Undergrowth Champion. We were pretty hot on the card when it was $8, and this was very early on in spoiler season, but after looking at the set more and having more people talk about it, Undergrowth Champion has already gone up to $20 pre-sale. So if you got in then, you know, just send us a little bit of a thank you. Undergrowth Champion is a card that, you know, it plays really well with all the landfall in the set, obviously, because it gets bigger and it doesn't get smaller. We've been also seeing a lot of attention on Woodland Wanderer. Now, this is a card that I dismissed as being dumb and goofy because I want to have really cool abilities, and coming to play and just being a Vigilance 5/5 is not cool enough for me. But greater minds have prevailed, and the finance community seems pretty interested in this. Either you guys want to talk about Woodland Wanderer as a potential pickup and whether you think it's going to sustain its price?
I have a really hard time buying into any rare from this set at all. It's just, we've seen in Cons of Tarkir that rare prices are very, very depressed. Part of that is the fetch lands. And yeah, I'm looking here at the market. We're looking at like $3.50 pre-order price, which seems about right to me. It doesn't seem like we are looking at something that's crazy underpriced. I mean, it's obviously a good card. It is priced like a good card, and I think it is a good card. But the real question to ask here is, what does it take for a rare in this set to be worth more than, I don't know, $2? I'm going to pull up the Cons of Tarkir data really quickly and just look through that. But
yeah,
Did you run into this Woodland Wanderer during your playtesting?
I didn't.
Interesting.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't run into... I mean, again, it's just one day. I'll be sure to continue testing, and some of that will be going into my you know, Battle for Zendikar set review for Rares and Mythics later on this week. So, I mean, it's good when it's good. Like, it's good in the decks that want it, but it's not one of those cards that's going to be a four of in every single deck that's playing green. Like,
Here's a question. I've got the Cons data up right now. And without surprise, the top five rares in Cons of Tarkir a year after release are the five fetch lands. The only rare above $3 is Dig Through Time. Sorry, I'm quoting buy list prices here, so I'll quote both. Dig Through Time's a little over $3 buy, about $5.50 sell. Siege Rhino, $2.50 buy, about $3.50 sell. And then Hardened Scales, $1.50 to $3.50. Battleclaw Mystic, $1.25 to about $2.50. But there are some very, very few cards in this set that are worth over $2. I mean, there are nine, and five of those are fetch lands, and then the rest are Dig, Siege Rhino, Hardened Scales, Battleclaw. So if Siege Rhino isn't $4, this is not Siege Rhino. I mean, it can stack up nicely against Siege Rhino, but it doesn't have it isn't Siege Rhino. Siege Rhino is that kind of card where if you can cast it, there's no reason you shouldn't jam four in your deck. It's just, it's that good. So I don't think pre-ordering this guy at $3.50 is where you want to be.
Yeah, and it's not even like Dig is a multi-format card, and it's still only at $3. So, I mean, this is nowhere near either of those cards. So,
Here's a question. What we do have to be diligent here, we have to ask ourselves, the fetch lands really changed the topography of Khans of Tarkir in that they sucked up all the value from the rare slot. The Tango lands are not the fetch lands, but we've also got the creature lands, and we've also got expeditions causing packs to be cracked more often. We've got different factors sucking value away from the average rare. So what do you think the comparison is between fetches and tangos in terms of how the set prices or the rare prices in the set will concentrate towards, say, the lands or a small subset of extremely versatile cards?
I expect that we will see slightly higher prices on rares and mythics because there aren't fetch lands to absorb that price. I think we could see a $3 to $4 price. You know, is something like Den Protector comes to mind as a card that can be sustained like that. One of the interesting things for me on this set, just looking at it as a whole, is that it looks like there are a lot of interesting strategies that Wizards is pushing on us that don't fit into existing decks. So they have to be very powerful to be better than just tapping out and playing a Siege Rhino on turn 4. But there could be some pretty interesting stuff. We have cards that ask for you to pay Converge mana. And, you know, this is Sunburst by another name. But it's interesting to see these. I don't know whether people will be able to make sustainable 5-color mana-based decks. If you could, this is the time to do it. But, I'm really looking forward to the next 3 or 4 weeks to see what decks people try out. And, that first Star City event after the release, when people start playing decks for the first time, that's going to be really cool, and I'm going to be kind of bummed if it's just blue-white control and Abzan and you know, a Tarka red. So I hope that we see some cool stuff. It's just I haven't seen a good explanation from anybody about what they think, whether these decks rate up or not. I haven't seen an analysis of whether the Ingest deck, for example, has enough to be pre-existing decks. So we're going to be seeing a lot happening in the next month, and it's great to pay attention to that. It's rare when I've seen a set this markedly different from the previous one and for what standard is that actually has good cards in it. So I'm excited for it.
What card excites you the most, and what card makes you want to go, gee, I want to brew around this guy? For me, it's Oblivion Sower, and it's okay if that's your choice too, but I'd like to hear what it is and why.
I like From Beyond. I'm not normally a tokens guy. I'm not a ramp guy, and this card is not blue, so it's real strange for me to be talking about that. So first off, Ulamog's Nullifier. I like that card a whole lot. I'm not going to take up any more time talking about it. But From Beyond is fascinating to me. I do like the ability that this is kind of like a force field. It lets you stop one creature every turn that attacks you until you get to the point where you either want to go around it or you can answer it or things like that. I mean, the Awaken cards, I just don't even know how to evaluate. Scatter to the Wind is the new 3-cost counterspell, and you can awaken a guy and turn it into a blocker or a finish.
And that card is shockingly expensive last I checked. I thought it was going to be, like, fine, but apparently I blew it in my evaluation.
I think it is a really good-looking card. It sucks that there's still just solid counterspells and that the dragon control decks can take out their dissolves and just slide that guy in and be like, okay, well, you know, now I have 4 more ways to kill you, and that kind of sucks. But it's interesting. There are a whole lot of abilities here that show a lot of promise. Theros is gone. Khans has what it is. I guess
ruling we'll question.
To see whether you can blend these together. I mean, it may just be one of those things like back when you were playing Blue-Green Madness and Judgment, and then Onslaught rolled around, and it's like, well, there's nothing in Onslaught for this. I'm not going to play it.
Yeah, the Awakened thing seems very powerful in the abstract, though. And just to be clear, the way it's worded, the Awakened thing is just added on to the resolution of the spell. It's not any sort of weird, like, when you cast the spell, right? So if you counter an Awakened spell, you counter everything.
That is correct.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm not super excited about Awaken. I could just say that right now. You're not going to be feeling super awesome at 7 mana to get a 4-4 when you're also playing Languish in your deck. So, I mean, there's some situations where the Awaken on, like, a Ruinous Path or something like that, where you're also playing Languish in your deck more often than not, you know, in these control decks. You know, it's kind of like a anti-synergy. But, I mean, you know, for those decks that against, like, Landfall and stuff like that, you're just straight up playing the 3-mana destroy a creature. I mean, you're not really hoping to get to the Awakened cost to try and close out the game. I mean, you're leaning on cards like Dragonlord, Ojutai, and stuff like that. So, I mean, Awakened tacked onto a card doesn't make me super excited about it. To answer your question, Kelly, I will also pick Oblivion Sower to be extremely lame and not creative, but, I mean, the card is insane. So, and actually, to pick another Mythic, because, Doug, you had an interesting point about saying some rares and Mythics probably will maintain some semblance of a price, and that's true. You're getting, like, this weird situation where we have two rare land cycles effectively giving us, like, a floor of the set, and then these expeditions giving us, like, a soft ceiling. So there are going to be a couple cards that can maintain some of their price. It's probably going to be in the really good rares and a couple mythics. But I got to say, Drana, Liberator of Malakir, we didn't get to talk about it on any of the other casts because it wasn't spoiled yet, but that card is literally kill this now or you lose. And really? I think that's perfectly fine for a creature.
Yes, what does the deck around her look like? Because in my usual fashion, I feel like I misevaluated her when I saw her. Like, yeah, that's a great creature. 2/3 flying first strike for 3 is crazy. But, like, what are you putting around that deck so that you have that deal with this or you lose now situation?
Well, if you, like, turn one, like, a Warden of the First Tree into a turn two, you know, person, two drops, like, I'm blanking right now, but Drana, like, if, you know, being on the draw and not having the instant speed removal for Drana basically locked me out of the game. I mean, Drana putting a counter on all of the creatures, including itself, basically ended the game, like, in two turns. It's really insane. Like, if you don't kill the creature within one turn, and even then, she leaves behind a newly buffed, you know, 1/2 drop or, you know, whatever else is on the battlefield. So it's really insane.
Yeah, one of the cards that I'm quite excited about is just a lowly common, Mortuary Mire. It makes a black mana, comes into play tapped, and when it enters the battlefield, you can put a creature from your graveyard on top of your library. Now, there's a whole bunch of things that...
When did you start printing cards like this at common? Right?
Seriously. I mean, this is a card that will be frustrating a lot of people. This is a card that makes me think about the Sultai Mill decks. And think, well, you know, if I'm putting 20 cards into my graveyard and then I can Mortuary Mire one of, like, a really good creature back, that's pretty good. You know, you can get your one Sidisi Bloodbrood Tyrant out and or your Sidisi and your tutoring Sidisi. And yeah. There's a lot of cool stuff that you can do with this. I'm excited to use it in Modern with Life from the Loam, because now when I cast a Loam, I can get back Mortuary Mire and then I can put an actual creature that I milled away on the top of my library. It's cool stuff. It's a very, very good card. I have a feeling that they're going to, like, in a year from now, we're going to look at Mortuary Mire, and Aaron Forsyth is going to print some Mea Culpa article where it's like, wow, I guess we really didn't expect that card to come out at common, and, you know, we really didn't expect people to be playing this card off color in their draft decks because they got to rebuy their biggest card.
Yeah, I am just shocked this card exists at anything less than a rare. If they had printed that at a rare, I think I would have said, yeah, that's reasonable. It's another spell land, and it doesn't provide true card advantage, but it provides card selection, and it provides recursion, and what recursion does is it makes sure you can do more of the same game plan, and the more that your deck can cast its best cards over and over again, the more likely you are to win. So I see this just having all kinds of bonkers applications. I mean, I love the idea that you can cast Sylvan Scrying as an Animate Dead. You know, I love it. You can just mill yourself with Life from the Loam. That's got to be one of my favorite synergies we've talked about yet. This is another one of those foils where I probably should have put that in my article, but that article was getting to be too long anyway. But yeah, this is the kind of foil where it's going to go directly into a lot of Commander decks immediately.
And I look at this card even, and I had offhandedly mentioned that we might see it splashed for, but there were players who would splash for off-color Ravnica bounce lands because that ability was so good and limited. Being able to buy back a big thing is really cool, too. I like this a lot. May not actually be constructed all-star, but we'll see.
If you had to pick the card from Battle for Zendikar that shows up the most in the Pro Tour Top 8 in 3 weeks, what do you think that card is? How dominant do you think it will be, or prevalent, I should say, do you think it will be, and why?
I think it's going to be Ruinous Path, and the reason why is that I think that that is an easy card to understand. You look at a card like the aforementioned From Beyond or the Ingest cards, and those, I think you have to like hit the recipe right to win a Pro Tour with those, whereas Ruinous Path is like, okay, I mean, you know what deck this goes in, just jam it in there and run it.
Fair, that's a conservative call. How many decks do you think will make the top eight with at least 2 copies of the Ruinous Path in their
set? Okay, I'm going to talk about copies instead. I expect that we're going to see 10 copies of Ruinous Path in the Pro Tour top eight.
I think that's a very good guess. Chaz?
So Doug picked the practical card. Yeah, because that's very safe. I don't know how many copies there will end up that we'll end up seeing play, but I gotta say I'm sticking by Oblivion Sower. I don't know how many copies we'll see play in the top eight, but I think there will be a good amount of them at the Pro Tour.
I agree. My pick is Beastcaller Savant, which is the 1 mana, well, the 2 mana 1/1 haste that taps for any color to cast creature spells. I think it is another obvious card that people understand how to play. It casts some of the best creatures in the format. It casts Siege Rhino. It casts Undergrowth Champion. And very, 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 very crucially, it gives you a mana of any color to cast Woodland Wanderer. So I think that it fits into any deck that has green cards in it. And the fact that it makes any color makes your Radiant creatures that much better. So it's cheap. It's a mana dork. It's got Lotus Cobra on it, so it kind of has the word Lotus in it, which always makes things more valuable. But I think we are going to see at least 2 decks running a full playset of these in the Pro Tour Top 8.
Yeah, that's a good pick. I like that. It's a very good card. I like that one, too.
Well, we are certainly going to know more by next week about what strategies are shaping up, and we will know more about even just watching the market to see what people are confident in what will go up. Well, you know that listening here helps you find wonderful cards like Undergrowth Champion at $8, which is now a $20 pre-order. And certainly as we go forward in the next few weeks, we're going to find a lot more. There's plenty to talk about even outside of Battle for Zendikar. I promise you when there's cool stuff in Modern going on, we'll be hitting on that as well. But until next week, I hope you really enjoy this show. You can comment with us. You can find us on QuietSpeculation.com. As usual, this show is posted a few days early to insiders and then posted publicly later in the week. You can find us on Twitter. You can get a hold of me at QuietSpec, and we'll have the guys rattle off where they are on that one, too. So until next week, I'm Doug Lynn.
I'm Kelly, Kelly Reed at Twitter, and always on the Quiet Speculation forums, of course.
Chaz Volpe at ChazVMTG on Twitter.
And until next week, you've been listening to MTGCast.